Before getting underway, I want to say a few words about the teaching today. Elliot, the 10-year-old, informs his brother or his sister. We couldn't quite remember whether it was Gertie or the older brother that he was talking to. But anyway, he says, listen, adults can't see him. And he meant by that, it seems to me, two things. One, E.T. is such a short, squishy little fellow that, as you remember in the one scene when he is in the kitchen and the mother comes home and is putting the groceries away and so on, and E.T. is kind of cruising around, she really can't see him. But on the other hand, in a larger sense, I think we are being told that there is a special access that young adults and children have to seeing what's in this film. So it seemed only appropriate, since it became and even more appropriate as we talked a bit last night, this is utterly unrehearsed, I should say, that I had seen some things in the film that they hadn't, and they had seen some things in the film that I hadn't. And so as we talk together through questions and answers, we can all hopefully learn something more about this staggeringly popular movie. Let me just get a show of hands, just to see as a kind of experiment, how many people in this room have seen E.T. at least once? Okay? Good. How many people in the room have seen it at least twice? Okay? How many people have seen it at least three times? Okay? How many people have seen it at least four times? Okay? And how many people more than four times? Okay. Okay. So you see already here, when we talk about E.T.'s being a popular film, it's popular not simply because so many people have seen it, but because so many people have seen it more than once. Indeed, as many as five or six times. And what we're going to do today is to try to figure out and think about what is really behind this movie such that people are so taken by it. Some of the miners told me last night that they, even when they saw it more than once, cried the second and third time. And I confessed to a couple of people who arrived too early that the same thing had happened to me. So it's not as though it's just a matter of enjoying it. It's a matter of being moved by it over and over again. Okay, so basically what I want to do as a kind of outline is to spend some time talking about the action or the plot of the movie, and then talk about some of its language, some of the speech, and maybe some of the scenes, and then finally some of the themes in the film. So let's start with some simple elementary questions and get the cast of characters straight. I've already mentioned Elliot. Now let's see, here's something that stumped the miners momentarily last night. We'll see if they can remember. Write Elliot's name on the board here. Now, who can remember what Elliot's last name is?
Taylor.
Right, Taylor. Elliot Taylor. You only notice this if you watch the credits very carefully and if you listen very carefully when the policeman comes in to inform, when the mother's called the policeman, she's worried about her son being missing, and he calls her Mrs. Taylor. Now, why is it important that Elliot's last name is Taylor?
Yeah. E.T. His initials are E.T.
Okay. Because now suddenly if he writes down his initials, E.T., okay? You can even do this with Elliot's first name. Notice the first letter E, the last letter T. So already just in the name of the leading character, we have a kind of close. Elliot writes his initials, he's E.T. And the creature that comes, E.T. Okay. Let's talk some more about the characters. Here is something that I couldn't remember last night, but they could, because they remembered the name of the person who's about their age. What's Elliot's older brother's name?
Michael.
Okay, Michael. And how old is Elliot?
10.
Okay. And Michael?
15.
Okay. And the sister, what's her name?
Gertie.
Gertie. Right. We were trying to guess last night how old Gertie was. I think we kind of agreed.
5 or 6.
She's around 5 or 6, yeah. Okay.
She's 6.
Oh, she is 6 for sure? All right. That's spoken with a kind of authority no one can deny. Okay, so we got Gertie, who's 6, Michael, who's 15, Elliot, who's 10. Some of the other leading characters. Who else would you say is a leading character?
The mom.
And she's just called, and she's just mom, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'd say another leading character. Well, E.T.
Okay. Maybe we ought to put E.T. up here, right next to our other E.T., Elliot Taylor. Okay.
I can't think of that. I don't know if he had a name, but the guy with the keys that at the end of the movie you found out that he had had an E.T. when he was younger, too.
Right. Okay. Let's call him. He doesn't have a name either. You're right. Let's call him the NASA man.
Yeah.
Okay.
I was carried around the keys.
Wasn't the mom called by a name? By the children?
Mom, I think
yeah.
Just called her mom, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I remember at the time thinking how unusual it was that they called her the name rather than by her first name. Because, you know, it
Helen.
Just it seemed very modern.
Yeah. Hmm.
Was it Helen?
Yeah.
I know a girl who calls her mom by her first name.
Does anybody remember the name? Do you remember the name? Or just remember that it was a name rather than mom?
I just remember there was a name.
Okay, I can't remember what it was. So let's just call her for the purposes of getting the action straight. Let's just call her mom. Maybe she does have a name. That would be interesting. Okay, so we've got NASA man, mom, Gertie, Michael, Elliot, and of course E.T. Okay. Film opens. Who can remember the very first thing we see in the film? The very first shot. Yes, back there.
E.T.'s people down on Earth feeding on the vegetation.
Okay. E.T.'s people are on Earth, all right, and they're interested in vegetation because they're collecting it, may or may not be eating it. And does anybody remember the shot that just after we see that inside the spaceship, the camera goes inside the spaceship and focuses on a lot of things inside. Remember what that was? Different kinds of what?
Mushrooms.
Right, mushrooms, plants. So clearly these people are interested in plants, in nature, okay? Whether they're eating it or not, or whether they're just collecting it, it's unclear. And then what happens to E.T. very quickly?
He gets left.
All right.
Well, they show the guys chasing him.
Okay.
All the E.T.'s.
They show the guys chasing him, but basically he gets very quickly left. He gets abandoned. So we have this creature, E.T., who is abandoned, lonely, isolated, and a stranger. A real alien, if you will. Now let's switch to Elliot for a minute. What's Elliot's situation at the beginning of the film?
Left out.
Okay, good. Let's list some of the ways in which he's left out. Can you list one for me?
They're all eating pizza and everything. They won't let him have any of it, or one of them play the game.
They never got any pizza. He left it outside and
stepped on it.
Okay. Yeah.
His sister is young, so when his mom pays a lot of attention to her, and his brother doesn't really want to know.
All right. Excellent. Excellent. You're really clued in to the kind of sense in which Elliot, too, is at the beginning of this film abandoned, okay? And you've mentioned some of the ways. In fact, you've reminded me of another character which we can almost assign as a group, the sort of neighborhood.
Gang.
Okay, I like that. Neighborhood gang, all right? So we've got, when we see Elliot, he's in the middle of a bunch of people, but you're quite right. He himself is alienated and lonely, or left out, as you put it. Okay, so because he's left out by the, I'm going to call him the NG, neighborhood gang, they won't let him play. Ever had that feeling yourself, that you'd like to kind of join a group, be a part of it, they exclude you? You know what that feels like? Okay. And then two, he's excluded by brothers and sisters because they get angry at him around the dinner table very quickly, and so he feels... Now, none of you, I take it, ever fight with brothers and sisters. That's probably... Okay.
He kind of feels lonely because his dad's so far away, too.
Fine. Excellent. In fact, probably the most...
In Mexico.
Okay. Probably the most...
He feels like his dad deserted him.
Right. You think that that's exactly what E.T. feels like with his people deserting him?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So what people have noticed here is that the opening situation features a child of 10, whose initials are the same as E.T., who's in the same situation. Okay. That is to say, he too has been abandoned. His father's left. He too feels left out. Friends won't let him play. Brothers and sisters giving him all kinds of difficulties. So in Eliot's world, he is an outsider. He is an alien. In fact, here's one more detail. Does anybody remember the name of the game that the kids are playing? Yeah.
Dungeons.
Is that what they're playing?
Yeah.
Okay. And remember what they say to E.T. To Eliot when he wants to join in? You can't just join this universe in the middle. In other words, they won't let him come in the middle. So the game that they're playing, you can't just join this universe in the middle, means that here in this universe, Eliot's outside of it, okay? Just like E.T. is an alien in this universe. So right away, as we've seen, first thing in the name, Eliot Taylor, E.T., and in E.T.'s initial, and in their opening situations, all of which happens, we see this all in the first couple minutes, there's a deep, profound psychological parallel of feeling and situation. The feeling of abandonment, of loneliness, of being excluded, being left out. Now what's going to happen? The action of the film. Now what I want to do is to jump way ahead, because if the film opens with that kind of situation for Eliot and E.T., let's go way to the end. Okay? Who is present during the very last scene of the movie? Which people are there? Yeah. Okay. Okay. Right?
Everyone.
Okay. In the last scene of the film, everybody we've designated as a major character is present. Now...
They're all revolving around Eliot and E.T. too.
Okay. How do you think these people feel about each other now? How do Eliot, his brother, and sister get along by this time? And in the last scene. Okay. They get along real good. What about the attitude of the neighborhood boys toward Eliot and his toward them? At first they don't. But by the time the last scene comes, do they believe it?
Yeah.
Okay. And so basically he's accepted into the neighborhood. Okay? Now the last one that you listed, because I forgot to put it up here, the whole question of the father. Is there anybody present in the last scene with the mother? Yeah, back there.
The NASA man.
Okay. The NASA man here and mom arrive together. And they're in the background, so that there's a kind of hint, a suggestion, that even that sense of having been abandoned by the father has been addressed, because now there's a man there with the mother who has acted toward Eliot very much like a father. Just a hint that there's even a kind of new father there for Eliot. Okay? So, let's just summarize. This movie traces a kind of movement from alienation, loneliness, abandonment, to reconciliation and reunion, and togetherness, okay? It opens with a kind of fractured society where Eliot's left out, where people are fighting, okay? Where people are excluding each other, and ends with a group that's harmonious and together, all right? So that's the beginning and the end, the kind of frame for the movie, the kind of storyline. Let's say one thing about the beginning and the end before we trace the actual development of the story. I asked before, what's the very first scene in the movie? And someone said, well, it's E.T.'s People on Earth. Actually, the camera, when the lights dim in the theater, the very first thing you see, the very, very first thing, are the stars, the heavens. And the camera then pans down to Earth, and that's where it picks up the scene of the spaceship in the forest, okay? And the very last scene in the movie, the camera has the opposite movement. It goes from the Earth and up to the stars, okay? Can anybody remember, as everybody's looking up, what they see in the heavens? Pardon? A rainbow, exactly. And can anybody suggest, drawing on your own experience in the Bible and so on, what a rainbow stands for? Yeah. Okay, you're thinking of the flood, and that's right. That's right. It's a symbol of promise. It's the sign of a certain promise that God gives. And you're right about what the promise was, that he wouldn't destroy the world again by water. But basically, you have the rainbow being a symbol of promise. So there's kind of hope and promise that we're left with a movement up into the heavens and with a community that's reassembled and together. But it's going to take a long time to get from the early state, both for E.T., who's looking for home, and for Elliot, who is also, you could say, looking for home. He's at his house all right, but the house, the neighborhood, the society's not quite a home. So it's a story about two E.T.s, Elliot Taylor and E.T., their search for a home, and the problem is, how are they going to find it? Each one separately, but really both finally together, because in a way they discover that each one separately can't find home without the help of the other one. So let's talk now about the storyline. What do you think for E.T. now are the obstacles, the things in the way of his getting home? What kinds of things does he have to overcome that kind of threaten him?
All those people looking.
Okay. All those people, we'll call them the NASA people. They're the folks running around carrying flashlights and riding in trucks and listening in and so forth. Okay, so there's a kind of external threat to E.T.'s getting home. Yes? Exactly. There's the problem. How is E.T. going to make any communication? How is he going to communicate with the people that are his own? Okay? Any other difficulties that cause a kind of tension that you worry about as far as E.T. is concerned? Yeah. His health, exactly. His health. Because as the film goes on, just as there's a kind of external threat to E.T. and the NASA people, there's an internal one. He's getting sicker. And Elliot picks this up. He says, gee, he doesn't look so good. So in other words, the dramatic tension of the movie from E.T.'s point of view is, will E.T. overcome these kinds of obstacles? Will he manage to communicate with his people? And if so, how? Will he stay alive long enough? Or will he die? Will he manage to elude the people that are after him? Yes. Okay, you put your finger on another whole movement and development in the film. All right? And that is, we've talked about the movement from alienation to reunion, from loneliness to society or community. But the other one is the closer and closer and closer and closer developing relationship between the two ETs. So in some ways, they become almost one, okay? Because remember, after a while, Elliot begins to talk about we. His brother Michael says, what do you mean we're sick? Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the ways, you've already hinted one, they feel one another's feelings. Beginning of the movie, to review, they're in the same situation. They're both abandoned. All right. Next, we see them together. Well, the first time we see them together, after Elliot finally meets E.T. and brings him to his bedroom, something starts to happen because E.T. gets sleepy. And how does Elliot feel?
Sleepy.
Gets sleepier. So there's the feeling of fatigue. E.T. feels it. Elliot feels it. Okay. Then we get the next feeling that they share, because Elliot goes off into the kitchen to get E.T. something to eat. E.T.'s kind of messing around there in the bedroom. opens an umbrella. He's startled, and Elliot, at the refrigerator, even though he's not in the same room, feels startled and drops the milk. Exactly. That's how we know he's startled, drops the milk. So we see that when they share a common name almost, E.T., and a common situation, now they begin to share, as Jenny put it, each other's feelings. Okay, now there's even a closer way. Well, I shouldn't say even closer. There's another way in which the two of them become almost one. Can you name that? And it has to do with the problem going on in the medical room when E.T. is dying. Pardon? Okay, he lets go of him. What is there to let go of in a sense? Remember that funny little TV screen and there you see those little lines and squiggles? Anybody know what that represents? Things like heartbeat, metabolism, and so on. Oh, exactly, vital signs, good. So in other words, it's not just that their feelings, though that's the next step, become identified, their actual metabolisms do, so that when they put them on the monitors, the kind of graphs follow exactly parallel lines. Until at a certain point, they, as you say, let go. Now then there's the final, what one might call, if we're talking about a kind of psychological bond or a feeling bond, empathetic bond between them that follows from their common situation, and a kind of, as you say, they share vital signs. The very last scene of the movie, I think, captures yet an even more profound bond. What is the last thing the two of them do? Yeah. They hug each other. Okay. Okay. So it's almost as though they're spiritually now, even though they're physically going to part at the end, there's a kind of spiritual unity between the two. And there's, in a sense, that there always will be. Okay, so one of the movements then that goes along with the main one of the movement from alienation to reconciliation, from loneliness to community, is the deepening bond between these two. Okay.
Also another thing, when E.T. was dying, that flower was wilting.
The flower was dead when he came into the movie, and then when he got into the room, he saw he was dying. So E.T., when the two feelings of E.T. and Elliot came together, the flowers were up, and then when they came apart, and they showed the flowers wilting and dying.
Yeah.
Okay. Let me repeat what you said. Okay. He said another thing that you notice is that when Elliot and E.T. are together and alive, the flowers bloom. That is to say, E.T. at one point looks at dead flowers and they come back alive. But then when E.T. dies, the flowers wilt. So there's even a sense in which the kind of life that E.T. embodies even touches not just human community, but nature itself, that is the flowers bloom when he looks at them. Okay? That's right. And they come back alive when he comes back
alive.
That's how
Michael knew that E.T. was dying, because he was in Elliot's bedroom at the time, and then he saw the flowers fall over. That's when he took off running upstairs.
So. Okay. He said that's how Michael knows that E.T. has come back alive, because Michael's off by himself. And when Michael sees the flowers come back, he knows something has happened. He first sees them wilt. He first sees them wilt, and that's how he knows E.T. dies. But the flowers bursting again with life is the way that he learns about E.T.'s coming back alive.
Yeah, he sees the flowers. They start rising back up, and he goes, "The flowers, the flowers."
And he asks if he could see E.T.,
mm-hmm.
And so he takes
Right. Right. Okay. What these people are helping to remind us of in terms of the story is that the way the plot goes involves E.T.'s really dying and E.T.'s really rising again. Okay. And that at the key moment of E.T.'s death, Elliot and E.T., E.T., as Jenny puts it, lets go of Elliot, because he basically doesn't want Elliot, who by that time is totally identified in terms of his metabolism, he doesn't want Elliot right then to follow him into death. He's going to a place that he doesn't want Elliot to follow, and he lets go. Okay? And then, as we've been reminded, we have all these wonderful signs of the resurrection in the flowers. I think we've talked enough now to remind us all of the basic storyline, the basic plot, the basic action. Pardon?
Did Josh
eat you? Michael says I'll never get my license for doing it.
He's never hardly ever doing it. He jumps in the van that's got a one of those tubes on it. It's
and there's men inside it.
And the men's, and so then Elliot comes back and starts unplugging the tube, and right when they're starting to go, they're a ways down the road, the people are just about to get into the van, they're coming up, close the last one, they go flying down the road.
Okay, you're helping us to remember the part of the story that we haven't called to everyone's attention, which is the whole sequence, once E.T. does rise again, of how everyone becomes involved in getting him back to that spaceship, okay? Everybody participates in that. Elliot does, the brother and sister do, the neighborhood, as you put it, gang does. Everybody's there helping him get home, just as his very presence has helped Elliot find home.
And Gertie goes, Michael and Elliot done yet, because if they are, I'm supposed to give this to you. She goes, well, give it to me now anyways. And that's how the mom knew that they left.
Right.
Otherwise, it would have probably break down, right?
Right. That's how the mom knows. She communicates secretly to the mother as to where they're going. Okay, and they're going right back to the scene that we see in the first shot of the film.
He had that transmitter he tried to reach him with.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's move along and talk about a couple of scenes and some of the language, because I want to impress all of us of how beautifully written this movie is. The woman who wrote it, Melissa Matheson, is a wonderful screenwriter, especially for children. She's the one who did the screenplay for The Black Stallion, which, how many of you have seen The Black Stallion? Yeah, okay. This woman, I think I shared this with some of you. This woman happened to be on the set of Raiders of the Lost Ark when Spielberg was making that with Lucas, who's the director of the Star Wars trilogy. And there, she fell in love with Harrison Ford. Harrison Ford, most of you know, as the kind of crazy space car driver in most of the Star Wars trilogy. He's the one that's running around with Chewbacca, the character that looks kind of like a lion. So, and Melissa Matheson and Harrison Ford, who are now married, got involved on that set, and Spielberg, who by then was thinking about the E.T. thing, asked her, because he'd seen her work in The Black Stallion, to do the screenplay, and she said she would. And she's written, it seems to me, an exceptional screenplay. And I want to kind of show you how carefully crafted it is by just calling attention to a little bit of the language and see if some of you can help remember. Think back now, and think of the scene where Elliot gets up, pretends to be sick, mom goes off to work, he's finally alone with E.T., and they're in the room together. And Elliot decides he's going to give E.T. a little orientation session, give him a little class in what goes on Earth. Shows him different things. Coke, some plastic soldiers, a peanut that turns out not to be a real peanut, but only a fake peanut, because that peanut's a bank and you put money into it, you don't eat it, and so on. Very funny scene, which I'll talk about in more detail later when I get to theme. But at the end of that, see if you can remember this, at the end of that, the last thing shows E.T., says, pulls up a model car, he says, now this is a car, and you drive around in it. And what does E.T. do with the car?
He eats it.
He eats it. That's right. Shows that he can't quite understand what's going on here. He tries to eat the car, and Elliot picks up, because he can empathize, realizes E.T.'s hungry. Okay? So he says, oh, you must be hungry. I'm going to go get you something to eat. Now, here's where we're going to start talking about language. Elliot's going to get E.T. something to eat. He's about to leave the room. He turns to E.T. and he says, stay. And then he says four words. Can anybody remember? He says, stay, I'll...
Yeah.
Say it louder.
I'll be right back.
I'll be right here. Okay? This is the first time in the film that you've heard these words. I'm going to write them. Okay, because it happens three times. Stay, exclamation point. I'll be out of ink. Okay. I'll be right here. Double exclamation point. So he's going to leave E.T. in the bedroom, but he wants to assure him he's going to be right here, that is, in the house. Now, when he turns to E.T. and says, now you stay, what do you think he's addressing E.T. to like?
Dog.
Okay. He's got a dog, okay? And he's talking to E.T. rather like he's a pet. Stay. I'll be right here. And this, I think, reminds us of a whole range of films that all of us have either seen or heard about, which this movie partly wants to bring to our attentions, of a child who is, as Elliot, we've already said, is excluded, lonely, and abandoned, who finds a pet. And he's treating E.T. at that point rather like a pet. So it's kind of like a Lassie story. Boy is abandoned, or girl is abandoned, excluded, alienated, finds pet, and the two become friends, okay? But this is only the first of the three times we hear these words. The second time we hear them, things are very much grimmer. Because this second time we hear the same words, they're spoken a little differently, and they're spoken after all of the medical people have arrived and E.T. is dying. Jenny said it just right. E.T. lets go. And the way he lets go is that it's now E.T. who turns to Elliot, who wants to stay with him. And it's E.T. who says, stay. And it's Elliot who responds, I'll be right here. In other words, E.T. is commanding Elliot, just like earlier Elliot had told E.T. stay. Now E.T. turns to Elliot and says, stay. But now he means something very different. He means, you stay here on Earth. You stay alive. Okay? To which Elliot then responds to comfort E.T., because he knows E.T.'s dying. He says, I'll be right here. Okay? So that's the second time. So now we've gone from a simple pet story, in terms of the way the language is used, to now a larger story of life and death. Okay? Now, who can tell me the last time we hear the words? That's right. And where does he point to? Anybody remember where he points? Heart or the... It doesn't really matter because the idea is the same. He points right to the center of his forehead. I'll be right here. Okay? And he says, and before he says that, he says stay. Because there's this scene which Elliot wants to go with him. But he says, stay, I'll be right here. Does anybody have a Bible back there? Can you get one? Somebody who wants to volunteer to read me something? Okay. Read me the last chapter of the Gospel of St. Matthew. The whole chapter? Is the chapter long? Oh, I'm sorry, verse. I'm sorry. The last verse of the Gospel of St. Matthew. Yeah, the whole chapter would have been a little...
The last verse?
Of the Gospel according to St. Matthew. Lo, I am with you always. There's a sense in which this, I'll be right here, which we've heard in three very different contexts, in the last one, because it's just before E.T.'s ascension, in a sense, okay? It's before he ascends into the heavens, and he turns to... Elliot, he says, I'll be right here. It's very much like, lo, I'll be with you always, okay? Because he points here, okay? Which opens up a whole vast range of questions about some of the similarities between the plot of E.T. and the story we find in the Gospel according to St. Matthew. Can anybody think of other ways, we've just mentioned one in terms of language, in which E.T. and what he does and how he is and what happens to him in the film is rather like Jesus Christ? Yes.
Maybe when E.T. let the disciples, when Jesus says, stay with them, let go alone, and pray to God.
Okay. There's a sense of being in their midst and then leaving them, and yet saying that he'll always be with them. What other things does E.T. do or suffer that is not unlike?
Yeah, his name comes back to life.
Okay. We've got a death and a resurrection. Okay?
And then an ascension.
And then an ascension. Okay? What other things does E.T. do that are not unlike the kinds of things that Jesus does that human beings can't do? What happens when Ellie gets hurt? Yeah.
He touches too close at first in his finger.
Okay. Remember the scene with the finger? In other words, this creature is capable of performing healing miracles. Okay? Yes.
Well, the Bible too, where it says, you know, come to me as little children, and how that goes, that's kind of the adults there in the movie are sort of unable to accept or see that idea is brought before, whereas the children, you know, are able to.
Okay. Very good. Yes.
When they're in their costumes and he has the sword to his head and E.T.'s going to, there's false drops of blood, and E.T. is going to even heal this, not understanding.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's. I'm glad you brought that up, because that is a really interesting moment in the film. And I want to talk about that moment. You know the moment she's talking about? Everybody remember it? When they're dressed up as costumes and the older brother Michael decides he'll pretend to be, have a knife through his head. And E.T., just as he's tried to heal Elliot's finger, thinks now that Michael is suffering and reaches up and tries to heal that. It's a very funny moment. Very funny. But you might say to yourself, well now, how is it that a creature that is this intelligent, this wise, can somehow not distinguish, it seems, between Elliot's real wound and Michael's fake wound? I mean, you'd think he'd be able to tell the difference, and it's a real puzzle. How could this be? And I have some thoughts on that, and I'll give you my thoughts and see if you think they hold up. Now, I have to tell a little story to do that. There's a whole tradition within Christianity about angels. Angels are described and characterized in many ways. But one of the great poets, the great English poet John Milton, who was blind, couldn't see, and yet he writes poems that are filled with images of light, wrote a wonderful poem, magnificent, the greatest English epic, called Paradise Lost, in which angels figure very prominently. And here's something that happens in that story. Satan, who is this huge, a kind of Mr. Yucco, is a huge, scaly monster down in hell, carrying shields and spears and after the creation that God has made, decides that he's going to sneak into paradise to tempt Adam and Eve to fall, okay? And when Satan does this, God sends down, before Satan arrives, one of his great angels, an angel named Uriel, to guard paradise from anyone invading it. And Uriel is up there in the orb of the sun. And Satan knows that if he comes up in his scaly, many-armed form, he'll never get by, so he disguises himself as one of the good angels. And he comes up to Uriel, and he says, I'm just here to observe the beauty of what God has made. And Uriel says, fine, go on. In other words, the one thing that angels can't detect is any form of hypocrisy or any form of fakery. And the reason that angels can't detect that is because since they're so perfect, They can't imagine what it's like for us to have divided hearts, for us to appear to be one way, but actually be feeling another way. Okay? Have any of you ever done that? Have any of you actually felt angry or hateful, but pretended to be loving and kind? Or have any of you ever felt internally torn between two conflicting emotions so that you weren't really what you appeared to be, and you could kind of feel this tension between how you appeared and how you really felt, and kind of got all bollocked up in that? Well, for Milton and for a number of Christian writers, the distinctive thing about angels is that for all of their wisdom and beauty and perfection, indeed because of their perfection, they simply can't make sense of a discrepancy between the way things really are and the way they appear. For angels, you are what you appear to be. There's never any of this inward discrepancy between appearance and reality. So, back to E.T., it seems to me that we're being given a clue, just as we noticed the parallel between E.T. and Jesus. There are some parallels between E.T. and the tradition of the angels, in that the one thing E.T. cannot do is to tell the difference between real owies and fake owies. Okay? He tries to heal them both. Things are what they appear to be. Now this, I think, ties in. Some of you have been elsewhere when we've had Bible study in the morning. But let me just tell you something that happened in one of the early Bible studies. Looking at the Torah, which is the new law for the freed Israelites, and one of the first laws in there is to treat strangers or to treat aliens well. Okay, remember I talked about E.T. being an alien? And Spielberg himself comes out of this tradition, okay, the Jewish tradition, and he's very well aware of the high priority that's assigned to treating strangers or aliens well. In fact, the Hebrew word here for stranger comes close, Paul Hansen even mentioned it, to alien. Okay? And in the Old Testament, there are other stories that haven't been discussed about whole cities like Sodom and Gomorrah getting into tremendous trouble because they've treated angels badly. And one of the reasons that the Hebrews always thought it's important to treat those who are strange or alienated well is because they might be angels. And whole towns were destroyed because people treated angels badly. So there's a theme in E.T., it seems to me, about you treat this alien well, which Elliot does, so that the NASA man finally says, I'm glad he came to you, because Elliot knows how to treat him. Okay. So it seems to me that the scene that you mentioned about E.T. trying to heal the fake wound tells us something very important about who E.T. is. Okay. All right, let me move on now to a subject that I think you'll find very interesting. And the theme I want to talk about is gender. The question comes up in the village all the time, and it has in some of the forums, some of you may have been to them, about how do we talk about God? He, she, is it a him or a her or what? Now my question to you is this, straightforward question to my panel of experts. Is E.T. male or female?
Female.
The reason I'm raising the question is because the film raises the question. Film raises it. How many people think E.T. is male? How many people think E.T. is female? Nobody. You thought that. You said you thought he was female. Oh, you were just saying. No one thinks he's female? She's female? It's female? Yeah. Well, I think there are a couple of references to the fact that E.T. could have been female. Remember there's a discussion in the closet between
Gertie and Elliot.
Exactly. And Gertie says, oh, is he a boy or a girl? What does Elliot say?
He
says he's a boy.
He says, well, he's a boy, of course. But now Gertie has something to say about that. Not right away, because what does she do as soon as Elliot disappears? Dresses E.T. up as what?
As a girl,
okay? So what we've got is we learn something about gender here. We learn that sex is biological, but gender is cultural, okay? We learn that when the little boy gets his say, is he a boy or girl? He says, well, of course he's a boy. And when the little girl gets her say, as soon as Elliot leaves, she doesn't pay much attention. She dresses him up as a girl. Elliot gets home and goes bananas over this. Right? So, in other words, we see that among children, each of them trying to come to grips with this stranger who's before them, who is in some ways very close, project onto that stranger, because they feel so close to him, their own gender identities. See him, the little girl sees E.T. as female, the little boy sees him as male, so I really don't think you can answer the question, and in some ways it's ultimately not important to answer the question, is he male or female? The important thing to see is, the girl in the movie thinks he's a girl, and the boy in the movie thinks he's a boy. Okay?
What about Michael?
Pardon?
What about Michael?
What do you think Michael thinks? Anybody know? Anybody care to guess what Michael thinks?
Probably a boy.
I think that's a good guess. Okay, so I just wanted to point that out. This comes close to the a point in the film about whether or not E.T. is at all human or shares something with humans. And there is a point in the film in which it's clear that he does. Does anybody remember that point? Yeah.
He likes watching TV.
Well, he likes doing a lot of things like watching TV that humans do. But there's something about even biology that we learn about. It's when E.T. is dying and the doctors are running around madly trying to do something to cure him. And one of them runs in and says, hey, he's got DNA. Meaning, DNA, here's a big word, desoxyribonucleic acid. All right, that's a good question. If I could answer it completely, I might be teaching biology. It's actually what's in human genetic material. It's the chemical that is at the heart of each one of everyone's cells, okay? It's the things that, it's the material that makes human beings biologically human, DNA. And one of the doctors runs in very excited saying, he's got DNA. So there's a sense in which E.T. is in some ways like an angel, in some ways, as we've seen, like Jesus, in some ways, very human. This might be a good time to talk about some other characters who E.T. is like. E.T. can do something for children that none of the characters I've mentioned so far can, and that is he can somehow make them fly. Right?
Yeah.
Can anybody think, among the panel of experts here, of any other character in a film or a book that you've read who can make children?
Superman.
Okay, Peter Pan. Superman can fly himself, but it's unclear, and he can carry kids around. But it's not clear that Superman can make other kids fly, but Peter Pan clearly can. And how do we know that the film, this is not just a surface similarity, but the film means us to think of Peter Pan in this connection? Did Peter Pan ever come up in the film directly? Anybody remember?
Miles reading Peter Pan's verdict.
Right. E.T. and Elliot are in the closet listening in to Mom. And Mom is reading to Gertie. And she's reading Peter Pan to Gertie. And she's reading a very important section of Peter Pan to Gertie, because she's reading the section where she says to Gertie, okay, this is in the Peter Pan book, if you believe strong enough and deeply enough, okay, Peter Pan will be fine. Peter Pan's under siege by Captain Hook and all the bad guys, okay? And so she says, I do believe in fairies, okay? And then, lo and behold, she turns the page, and Peter Pan is fine, okay? So there's a sense in which this movie is tapping in what I'm trying to show you very explicitly in pointing to an enormous wealth of children's stories. Peter Pan, I've mentioned, okay? The whole Lassie and child with animal motif is being woven into this film, okay? I'm starting to kind of approach the question, why is it so popular? I think it taps so many of the deep and formative stories that have shaped all of us, regardless of how old we are, and put it together in a very sort of fluent and coherent way. Okay, now, the next topic that I want to raise. I've talked a little bit about gender, and that's the question of science. How does E.T. manage to build, what does he use to build the device that he uses to phone home? Yes?
He uses a saw blade, he uses a speak and spell.
Speak and spell, right. A fork, right? We got a fork. We got a saw blade. We got a spill and a speak and spell. A what? An umbrella, right? What's he put on the umbrella?
Tin
foil. So we got tin foil, umbrellas, speak and spell, a fork, a record player, string. Okay. Thank you. That was going to be my next question. Now you're so smart that I can't even you answer the questions before I ask them. There's an image here of, she said he uses the wind in the trees to power the thing that he builds. In other words, the power source is nature itself, because he ties the rope from the little device he's made onto a tree. Remember that wonderful night scene when, you know, he go out and he takes the machine. and it's only when the wind starts to blow and comes up that the machine has power and it's an act of communication. Okay, what I want to suggest is that there's a certain kind of positive vision of science in harmony with nature, powered by the wind, in which E.T., this wonderful creature, just takes bits of junk, an old fork, a used saw blade, an old record player, a used speak and spell, puts something together for an act of communication, okay, which is what he's interested in doing. He's interested in getting back in touch with his own people, that's powered by nature. And there's something very enchanting and positive, it seems to me, about that vision. We get another thing about science, because we have Eliot in a science class. Anybody remember what happens in the science class? What science it is? Yeah, Karin.
They're going to dissect the frogs and let them all go.
Okay. Remember this scene now? They're going to dissect the frogs for the sake of science, and Eliot... Eliot what? Okay, he looks at them real strange, like they may be E.T.'s too. They kind of remind him of E.T., that's right. And he liberates them. So there's a sense of kind of liberation here over and against the kind of effort to dissect in a certain way. And so that's another area in the film that sort of science comes up. But E.T. clearly stands for liberation and freedom in that case, with this funny scene of Eliot liberating the frogs. Okay. Now let me come up to another topic, which I might not, let's see, it's almost, I might have a little time to develop this. This is a kind of an interesting thing to see in the film. And it again, I think, is a tribute to Melitha Masterson that she's written it so carefully. The kind of story that I've summarized and that we've kind of put together, the movement from loneliness, alienation, abandonment, to reunion, social harmony, and community, suggests something not unlike what had come up in a session some of you attended the other day, by the way, with Robert McAfee Brown. He was talking about one of the novels that Elie Wiesel had written, in which a character learns by being with another character, just the two of them in prison, that in saving the other, he saves himself. And there's a sense in which, in Eliot's efforts to help this stranger, Eliot helps himself find home again. So there's a sense in which this closeness between the two, it's very hard to separate out Eliot's helping E.T. from Eliot's helping himself, because it's in helping E.T. that he restores community again, that he wins the confidence of the neighborhood gang, that he wins, that he falls back into harmony with his brothers and sisters, and that he regains a new father, okay? Now, the name that we use for this kind of story is comedy. Okay? It's a comic plot. Some of you have reminded us of funny scenes. Comedies are funny, and there are many funny scenes. If we had more time, we'd talk about all the laughs in this movie, because there are many funny scenes. But also, it's this movement from alienation to community that is finally defines the comic plot. The comic plot that most adults now are most familiar with in film is romantic comedy. That is to say, the typical plot is, I don't know if any of you have ever been in love. Maybe so, maybe not, with a young man or a young lady. But the typical comic plot line is two lovers who somehow become separated, whether it's married people who divorce, or whether it's two people in love, one of whom moves away, and the whole story then is a story of how these people get back together. So it the typical romantic comedy goes from lovers being separated to lovers being reunited, okay? Either by remarriage or by coming together and marrying or whatnot. That's a typical funny romantic comedy. And the reason I mention that is Spielberg's very aware of this because think hard, after E.T. turns on the tube, the TV set, he sees three different kinds of movies. And the last one that he sees, the first one is cartoon farce, cat's tail's on fire, and it's a cartoon. Okay, E.T. has elements of cartoon farce in it. A lot of farcical things happen. Second one he sees is science fiction. There's a spaceship up here. It's kind of beaming down and so on. And the third one he sees, can anybody remember? What's the last one he sees? Yes.
Soap opera.
Well, a kind of soap opera. What goes on in it? What happens on the screen?
Kissing.
What? Go ahead.
Kissing.
Can anybody hear, that? She says they're hugging and kissing. Okay? In other words, remember this scene? The hero's inside some kind of cabin, and he swings the girl back into his arms and gives her a big kiss. Okay? And what? A big hug and kiss. And what does Elliot do in the meantime? Yes?
He steps up on a boy and kisses the girl he likes. He swings her from the door.
That's right. He steps up on a child that's fallen down and gives her a big kiss. Boy, she's surprised. The little blonde girl with braids, okay? So, E.T.'s watching a movie. It's a romantic comedy. The hero swings the girl into his arms, gives her a big fat kiss. This is the only time in the movie, think about it, where Elliot shares E.T.'s perceptions, what he sees. All the rest is his feelings, fatigue, fear, love, and so on. But this time, Elliot sees something on a screen, a movie, and lo and behold, Elliot at school acts that scene out, and it's a romantic comedy. But this movie wants to do something larger than romantic comedy. Just like it doesn't want to stay in language at the dog story level and moves us up from stay, I'll be right here, all the way to stay, I'll be right here, meaning a kind of lo, I'll be with you always. Because what it does, it takes that same gesture of a hug, you see, which the first time we see it is simply farcical. It's simply silly. It goes on in the classroom. It comes from what E.T. sees on the screen. It takes that same gesture of a hug and puts it at the very end of the film. But this time, it's a very different kind of hug with a very different kind of meaning. This time, it's Elliot and E.T. embracing, and this time, it's not a kind of physical or romantic union. It's something much deeper, a kind of spiritual unity, which is found, and this is the last word I'll say, which is found in this film in the presence of community, because the community is all restored at the end. Okay, well, I've kept you over time, so thanks very much.